This is Audible.
Blood Betrayal, Blood Curse Series, Book 9, written by Tessa Dawn, narrated by Eric G. Dove, and containing a bonus uncut reading of The Curse for audiobook listeners only. The Blood Curse, 800 BC, Romania.
Your punishment has been decided.
In the dark Romanian castle of their beloved homeland, the royal twins, Jaeger and Jaden, fell to their knees on the cold stone floor while the remaining males of their kind waited anxiously outside the castle walls to hear the edict. Their thick black hair fell forward, shielding their terrified eyes from their accuser, as torchlight cast eerie shadows upon the dank gray walls around them. Their accuser was the blood of countless victims, each one slaughtered without mercy. The grim face of death, eager to exact revenge.
"Great celestial beings, have mercy on our souls!"
Jaden pleaded as the ghostly apparition drew closer.
"You make me sick, brother!"
Jaeger spat the words, unable to conceal his rage or his arrogance. The shadow weaved to the left and then to the right like a phantom pacing. And then it bent into a horrible arc of darkness, dipping down until at last it hovered face to face with the trembling men. Oh, gods! Flushed and swaying, Jaden Demir reached out with a firm hand to steady himself against the ground. He cast a sideways glance at his older twin, who was now as pale as moonlight.
"From this day forward, you shall be cursed, and your sons shall be cursed, and their sons after them, unto all eternity."
The shadow drifted closer, and a heavy mist settled on their skin.
"And to make certain your suffering is inescapable, you shall be made immortal, condemned to roam the earth in darkness as reviled creatures of the night, forever forced to feed on the blood of the innocent to survive."
Jaden inhaled sharply, his heart pounding in his chest. Despite his iron resolve, Jaeger collapsed on the floor. The ghostly aberration continued.
"As punishment for your unspeakable crimes against women, you shall never know the love or companionship of a female, nor shall you be capable of producing female offspring. Your sons will be born in sets of twins, two children of darkness, the spawn of human hosts who will die wretchedly upon giving birth, even as the firstborn of the first set will be demanded as a sacrifice of atonement."
The phantom glowered with fury.
"Failure to yield the sacrifice will be met with a hideous and terrible death."
The damp walls of the cavern creaked as if moaning beneath the pronouncement, and the torches flickered in and out as a deep red glow consumed the once yellow flames. Jaden Demir shook like a child, unable to awaken from a nightmare. His chest heaved as he struggled for breath.
"I beg of you, grant mercy!"
The words came out in a rush. The phantom dipped and hissed.
"Speak quickly!"
Jaden cringed and averted his eyes.
"I beseech of you, before all of heaven, before the ancient ones who came before us, and in the presence of the celestial gods, remove this curse upon my house and the house of my descendants."
The shadow stood still, listening. Then all at once, Jaden's voice became a haunting song of sorrow, a sound so melodious that the room lit up and the moon and stars dipped down to hear the beleaguered prince's words. Beneath a wind of grace and power, his plea took wings and flew.
While I have walked among the warriors who have sacrificed our women, I have never taken life with my own hands. Although I have failed miserably to save the innocent, I have tried to convict the guilty. And while it is true I have enjoyed the privileges of the mighty, my heart has wept for the weak. Your wrath is deserved. Your punishment is just. But I beg of you, search my heart, and have mercy upon me and my house.
Clearly disgusted, his older twin sat up and slowly turned his head to the side, his stark onyx eyes narrowing with contempt. He cursed Jaden beneath his breath and held his gaze in an angry glare.
Remember your place, brother. That which curses us now is the blood of the slain, the wretched females we offered to the gods for our birthright, to be worshipped beside the celestial deities. Plead not with these inferiors for mercy. We are the strong, the powerful. What we did was justified, and I will not beg mercy of a female.
The room erupted into angry flames. Sparks flew through the air like fire and brimstone. A revolting abomination of heat licked at the brothers' skin, yet it did not consume their flesh. And then the voice of the slain cried out from within the flames.
Ours was once a proud and noble race. Before you led the corruption of our men beyond the abyss of evil.
A blast of rage scorched the dark twin's eyes, turning his pupils from black to red as he was brought to his belly before his accuser.
In your thirst for power, Prince Jaeger, you have sacrificed the last of our females, our powerful sisters, mothers, and daughters, the keepers of the secrets of our race. You have not achieved greatness. You have brought an entire civilization to its knees, to the verge of extinction.
The blaze then formed a halo around the body of the male who had pled so eloquently for mercy.
And Prince Jaeden, we have searched your heart and find your words to be true. You, your house, and your descendants alone shall be granted 4 mercies accordingly. Though still creatures of the night, you shall be allowed to walk in the sun. Though still required to live on blood, you shall not be forced to take the lives of the innocent. Though still incapable of producing female offspring, you will be given 1 opportunity to obtain a mate, and the sign of her arrival shall be heralded in the heavens. Though still required to atone for the sins of your people, your twin sons will be born as 1 child of darkness and 1 child of light, and you shall be allowed to sacrifice the former while keeping the purer soul to carry on our noble race.
And so, banished from their homeland in the mountains of Eastern Europe, the descendants of Jaeger and the descendants of Jaeden became the vampyr of legend, roaming the earth, ruling the elements, living on the blood of others, forever bound by an ancient curse. They were brothers of the same species, separated only by degrees of light and shadow. Prologue. Present day, Denver, Colorado. Saxon Olaru sidled up to the bar in Denver's infamous Lodo, a native urban term for lower downtown, and tried to make himself as inconspicuous as possible. It was a losing proposition. At 6'2", he had soft hazel eyes the color of swirling caramel, and light ash hair that was neat on the sides, wavy and wispy at the front, tapering softly down a strong, masculine neck. The eye immediately caught a strong angled jaw and chin beneath a perfectly groomed silken goatee, and features so pristine, so precisely sculpted, that his high cheekbones looked as if they'd been carved out of marble. In other words, Saxon Olaru usually caught every eye in the room. He dripped sensuality, oozed masculinity, and practically radiated primal confidence. He was the muscular epitome of power, lethality, and grace, and women were drawn to him like moths to a flame. As for men, well, they felt his presence like a blast of virility and dominance sweeping through the room, a twister devastating everything in its wake. Intimidating was a mild word for Saxon. But yeah, his goal was to remain inconspicuous. Good luck with that. He ordered a second shot of Elijah Craig's single-barrel whiskey from the female bartender, gave her a gentle but effective mental command to go about her business, since she happened to be staring at him like a dolt with her mouth hanging open, and drool rapidly pooling along the corners of her mouth, about to leak onto her chin, and turned to glance at the seemingly average businessman wearing an overly expensive tie with an extremely cheap suit in the farthest corner booth of the bar. Anthony Beckman. Kate Beckman's ex-husband. The one who had broken her jaw and was this close to molesting their 3-year-old daughter during one of his court-approved visits. What the hell? Saxon repressed a growl. Anthony was one of the human males on Rebecca Johnston Lacusta's hit list, and he was only too happy to take him out. Okay, so it wasn't supposed to be a hit list. At least, not necessarily. But try explaining that to Nathaniel Silavasi. The ancient master warrior had already removed Eli Thomas's fingers for breaking Nancy's arms, dismembered Royo Jones for causing Sheila to have 2 miscarriages, and no, Royo didn't live through the ordeal, and gouged out Hugo Gonzalez's eyes for refusing to leave Teresa alone. Apparently Nathaniel figured that would put a dent in Hugo's stalking. The list was supposed to be at least somewhat benign. The warriors were supposed to scrub their brains, implant new suggestions on how to live a kinder life, ensure that these miscreants would never threaten a woman again, and Saxon supposed that Nathaniel had met that criteria in his own creative way. After all, 3 down, 2 to go. As it stood, Nathaniel was off stalking Julius Schaffer, Patricia Sykes's one-time, one-date NFL player, and Saxon was hunting in Lodo, handling Anthony Beckman, or at least he was about to. Problem was, Saxon had already searched Anthony's soul, and it was nothing but black, murky sludge. The man was as evil came, and as sociopathic as a serial killer. He possessed 0 capacity for remorse or empathy, and he would never, ever stop terrorizing Kate. It was stamped all over his demented brain, and that meant only one thing. This one had to be put down. For good. Saxon tossed back the second shot of whiskey, slammed the glass on the bar, and made his way toward the back of the room, trying to saunter past the booth as seamlessly as possible. There was no need to create a scene. No need to grab the bully by the scruff of the collar and drag him out of the establishment in order to handle the business in a dark, secluded alley. The way Saxon saw it, he could simply snap the idiot's neck in the space of a heartbeat, leave him propped up like a drunkard still sitting in the booth, and close his eyelids if necessary with the sweep of his hand, make it look like he'd simply passed out. It might be an hour or more before anyone noticed. Then again, it might only be 5 minutes. Saxon grimaced. Damn. He hated to cause that kind of drama for the employees or the establishment. But when he weighed their angst against the threat to Kate Beckman's daughter, it just didn't seem that bad. Besides, humans could deal with their own affairs. After all, they had created the laws that allowed such injustice to continue in the lives of so many women. They had devalued their females and their children, in spite of what they claimed, in every penal code they wrote. And still they viewed outright violence, assault, and terror as domestic disturbances in nature. Whatever the hell that meant. By slapping perpetrators on the wrist, releasing pedophiles from prison, and viewing rape in the context of sex, as if that had anything to do with it. Violence was violence, assault was assault, and crime was crime. And a society that wielded a harsher penalty for stealing money than destroying virtue deserved a little mess in an otherwise pristine booth. It was what it was. As Saxon sidled by Anthony's table, he met the human's gaze with a nod, and then he felt his own eyes turn feral. He knew they were glowing red. It was simply a natural instinct. The human's jaw dropped open as if he were about to scream, and Saxon squelched the sound in an instant, turning it off with a brusque mental command. A sweet primal moment laced with terror and imbued with fear, The knowledge that something horrific was about to take place flashed in Anthony's pupils, but it never had a chance to reach his twisted brain. Saxon grazed the human's cheek with his thumb, anchored his jaw with his palm, and placed the opposite hand on the opposite cheek as if in a lover's embrace. With a sharp, swift rotation, both wrists working in tandem, he twisted to the right, then back to the left, listening for the telltale pop that indicated the broken vertebrae. It was swift, it was effective, and it was finished. Anthony Beckman was dead. Saxon pressed the human's heavy body back against the seat, using one hand to steady his torso, the other to secure his balance. As the man's head fell forward, suspended above his chest, Saxon allowed him to slump into a resting position, and then he closed Beckman's eyes. Smoothing his right hand through his hair, Saxon swaggered past the booth and instantly muted his appearance as he turned on his heel and headed in the opposite direction, toward the establishment's front door. He wasn't completely invisible and he wasn't crystal clear. His presence was like an impression, a ghost or a breeze. Others would feel him, they would know he was there, but they would not be able to see, touch, or discern his presence in a way they could actually place. He wouldn't seem real or tangible. As he stepped outside into the crisp night air, he drew in a deep, purging breath, rolled his shoulders, and stretched his neck before deciding to take a stroll around the block. Nathaniel was hunting on the opposite end of town, taking care of Mr. Schaffer. It might be another 15 or 20 minutes before they could head back to Dark Moon Vale. Might as well see the sights. Kyla Sparrow stood behind her identical twin sister in the tiny one-room bathroom at the back of the Lodo bar, watching as Kiera reapplied her liquid eyeliner in the murky mirror, creating a perfect symmetrical line, and she pretended to listen as Kiera talked. Blah, 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 blah. It wasn't that Kiera wasn't funny, interesting, and smart, or even beautiful. She was inside and out. But that and a nickel would buy Kyla a gumball, something she didn't need. Kyla Sparrow had much bigger concerns on her mind, much bigger fish to fry than petty, monotonous, everyday affairs. And because of that, she and her twin sister really didn't vibe. In fact, they hadn't vibed for years. Ever since their freshman year in high school, Kyla had known she was different. While Kiera had been a straight-A student and a practical virtuoso with her violin, impressing classmates and teachers alike with her vibrant, intelligent personality, Kyla had been morosely withdrawn. Not only had she shown very little interest in making friends, pleasing her teachers, or pursuing some extravagant talent, she had become more and more distrustful, increasingly pessimistic, and decidedly different as each new day dawned. And it wasn't just a matter of extrovert versus introvert or social versus antisocial. It went a whole lot deeper than that. Kyla harbored an internal rage. She was prone to fits of violence, often envious, resentful, or just plain combative, and to most of the people around her, she was an oddity, a rebel, even a threat. Sure, she shared her identical twins' genes, good looks, and even her uncanny intelligence, but it all manifested in a completely different way. Kyla needed to know why. Why were people so stupid and unteachable? Why did nations let their enemies win? Why didn't leaders employ any means necessary to achieve their individual goals, establish collective dominance, and create a hierarchy where the strongest would always survive? Why did they make so many excuses for the sick, the defective, and the simple among them? Why didn't anyone else see that they were all just a bunch of dumb, mindless goldfish swimming around in a bowl, waiting for someone to feed them, take care of them, direct them as to where to go, what to say, and how to live? Repeating the same tiresome routine day after day, year after year, life after meaningless life. And that's when she had met Owen Green, the handsome, charismatic leader of the Denver Militia, a secret society of vampire hunters engaged in a much grander cause. At first, Kyla had thought Owen was full of malarkey, with all his fanciful tales of fanged creatures who stalk the night, dark ones and light ones, opposing houses, and moons that turned the color of blood. But Owen had made her a believer over time, over a lot of shocking, revealing, and illuminating time. And more than that, he had shown her things, photos, diaries, gravestones, as he had increasingly gained her trust, all of which left little room for doubt that vampires were definitely real. Now, 13 years later, Kyla was more than a believer. She was a full-fledged initiate in the metropolitan area's secret cell. She was honor-bound and 100% obedient to a headhunter she had never met, a regional leader by the name of Xavier Matista, the male who had recruited Owen. In fact, not only had she gone through all the secret trainings, attended all the late-night briefings, and followed the society's every clandestine move, she had committed herself fully on December 1st of her 25th year by submitting to a full, irreversible hysterectomy in order to become eligible for fieldwork. The society paid very well, and they took excellent care of their own. They were all that was standing between humanity and the monsters, and Kyla was ready to make her first kill. Knowing that any creature she hunted could very well be a dark one, a powerful and dangerous aberration from what they called the House of Jaeger, the hysterectomy had been a must. No pain, no gain. No risk, no reward. Kyla wasn't playing a child's game, and she understood that truth on a deep, intrinsic level. Keeping up with her old life, pretending to be an active member of her family, meeting with her twin from time to time, to engage in the mundane was all part of a necessary front. She had to pretend to be a functioning member of society as a whole, even as she knew she was the race's defender. Slowly and over time, Kyla and others like her would help to usher in a new age, a purer society, where the strong ruled the weak, and the mighty inherited the earth. Their goal was simple. First, cleanse the earth of the vampire. Next, claim dominance over unworthy humans.
"So what do you think of this color eyeliner?" Kiera asked in her usual welcoming tone. "It's kind of a blue-green, maybe aqua? I'm not sure if it goes with my eyes."
Kyla plastered an insincere smile on her face and glanced at Kiera's makeup.
"I think it looks gorgeous on you."
What else could she say? Her identical twin was a stunning beauty, just as Kyla was. In the end, what did any of that triviality matter? She was just about to suggest that they leave the bar, perhaps try to find a good movie. At least then they wouldn't have to talk through the show, when she noticed something both curious and intriguing on Kiera's left arm. Kyla stepped closer to the mirror and stared into the glass. The gentle hand that held up the eyeliner pencil was softly rotated outward, and as inexplicable, impossible as it seemed, Kiera's inner wrist was changing, metamorphosing right before Kyla's eyes. She reached out to grasp Kiera's wrist.
"Let me see that,"
she whispered, suddenly feigning interest in the pencil, even as she secretly shielded and surveyed her sister's arm. Wow. Whoa. This could not be happening. Etched into Kiera's flesh, and becoming more and more distinct as each second passed, was a series of enigmatic lines and cryptic dots, all of them intersecting to create a clear, discernible pattern. A celestial constellation. Cetus, the sea monster. Kyla swallowed a gasp and tried to remain calm. She knew exactly what she was staring at. After all, she and her other vampire-hunting cohorts had learned all of the celestial constellations. Correction. They had learned all of the celestial gods, those who ruled over the lighter vampires, and they had committed the pantheon to memory. Ever since the end of June of the previous year, the society had begun a new, intensive series of training, after their formerly indifferent regional headhunter had suddenly stepped things up, with a vengeance. No longer content to keep the lower echelons in the dark, Xavier had flooded the militias with information about the race they were hunting, about the history of the vampire, about their culture, their practices, and their religions. Kyla hadn't understood it at the time. If the higher-ups possessed all this knowledge, why had they kept it to themselves for so long? Why had they been so content to simply order the militias around, while they themselves remained in the shadows and led from afar? Why hadn't they shared all this history and culture decades ago? While part of that equation remained true, Kyla had never met their region's headhunter, and she doubted that she ever would. The most important part had definitely changed. The militias were now armed with more information and a deeper understanding of the enemy than they had ever possessed before. Careful not to alert Kiera, Kyla sauntered to the bathroom door and double-checked the lock. Yep, the door was securely fastened. No one would walk in. But that wasn't going to hold for long. Somewhere out there, either close by in the bar or within a few city blocks, was a vampire gazing at the moon. He would be feral, desperate, and determined, like a lion intent on protecting its pride, to find the unsuspecting female who was standing in this cubicle. And he would not be denied. And maybe, just maybe, if Kyla could pull it off, she could somehow switch places with Kiera before the monster found them. Wouldn't that be the deception of a lifetime? The greatest advantage the militia had ever had. Knowing that the moon would not be visible to her human eyes, Kyla immediately switched her tack. She hurried to the small rectangular window on the far side of the lavatory and pointed at the sky.
Kiera, come here, quick. Look at this. Do you see what I see?
Her voice was thick with wonder and awe. Kiera tucked her pencil into her purse, still unaware of her arm, and paced to the back of the bathroom. She glanced out the window and her jaw dropped open.
Holy moly, she exclaimed.
Yep, there it was. Confirmation.
The moon is the color of blood. And the stars. What the heck is that? I've never seen anything like this.
Kyla didn't bother to respond. She didn't have time. She reached into her purse, retrieved her cell phone, and pecked out an urgent text.
Owen, it's Kyla. Still at the bar with Kiera, and you're not going to believe this. She has the mark of a destiny on her left arm. Does Travis still own his tattoo parlor? If so, you need to get him and his tools down to Lodo now. There's a door in the bathroom that leads to an alley. It's behind the bar. Kiera and I will be waiting for you. I don't have to tell you what all of this means. If we can pull this off, I can take out this vampire. Hell, we can infiltrate their lair. Get here right away.
1. Saxon Olaru had traveled about 10.5 blocks from the lower downtown bar when he felt a sudden surge of electricity course through his spine. The hairs on the back of his neck prickled, his skin began to tingle, and his field of vision narrowed, which only meant one thing. His pupils had just constricted. Being over 700 years old, he recognized the physiological changes for what they were. Manifestations of a primal instinct, his feral nature rising, something happening to his body on a purely primordial level. Something ancient, something primitive, something that called to his inner nocturnal beast. He slowed his pace, tilted his head to the side, and tuned in acutely with all five senses. He could hear songs streaming through various headsets, music playing on apartment stereos, lovers in their lofts whispering sweet nothings, enticing one another to bed. He could smell perfume and cologne, shampoo and body wash, all intertwined with the stench of carbon being emitted from various tailpipes. There was a hot dog stand 10 blocks away, and a small coffee spill on the corner. Someone was firing calzones in an old-fashioned brick oven, and someone needed stronger deodorant. He could sense moisture in the upper atmosphere, a bitter cold front developing rapidly, but it was moving quickly east. It would likely arrive as a winter storm in Kansas no later than Tuesday morning. Yet and still, as he tuned into all the various stimuli, there was nothing he heard, smelled, or felt that explained his rising tension, the feral heat igniting his blood. And then he glanced at the sky. Great celestial gods of his ancestors. The moon was shining crimson, cerise saturated and luminous, like the lens of a camera slowly zooming out to capture a much wider picture. He broadened his focus to the sky as a whole and gawked at the brilliant black canvas. The celestial constellation Cetus, the sea monster, was illuminated above him, blazing like a heavenly bonfire. Saxon Olaru was staring at his own blood moon. His fangs began to throb in his gums, his naturally manicured nails lengthened, and his vampiric nature took over. A low, feral growl rose in his throat as he spun around lithely and stalked back in the direction he'd come from. Kiera Sparrow screamed as the back door to the restroom flew open, and two terrifying men rushed in from the dark, narrow alley. The first of the two was tall, dark, and masked. The second was short, stocky, and covered in tattoos. She dropped her purse, reached instinctively for her sister, and drew back in sudden alarm. Kyla shook loose from Kiera's grasp, shoved her toward the men, and shuffled out of the way, with indifference.
Kyla!
Kiera gasped, trying frantically to read the situation.
What the hell is—
Shut up! The tall, masked stranger barked, placing his palm over her mouth from behind.
I'll get her arms!
The second man shouted, swiveling around to face her.
Hurry!
Kyla chimed in.
Do you know how fast a vampire can travel?
Kiera froze for the breadth of two heartbeats, totally stunned by the sudden invasion, as well as her sister's odd statement. Do you know how fast a vampire can travel? What the hell was happening? And then her survival instincts kicked in, and she began to twist wildly, trying to break free from the masked man behind her, even as the tattooed intruder restrained her by both biceps. Everything happened so fast. Kyla reopened the door, the one that led to the alley, and the man behind Kiera, his hand still over her mouth, began to drag her backward into the cool night air. The temperature was frigid, the alley was putrid, and the dark, haunting sky loomed like a red-mooned nightmare above them, as the masked stranger hauled Kiera, kicking and grunting, into a nearby van. She tried desperately to scream, she tried to bite his hand, but his grip was too hard, too firm, too unyielding, and his buddy was helping him out. And Kyla? Where the devil was Kyla? Why wasn't she helping Kiera escape? Kiera's gaze shot wildly around the vehicle as she tried to locate her sister. Kyla was perched on her knees in the back of the van, leaning over a box full of tools. She was rolling up her sleeve and exposing her wrist, cleansing it with some sort of antiseptic. To hell with this shit. Were they about to shoot drugs? Kiera didn't care to find out. She summoned her courage, gave full vent to her rage, and began to struggle in earnest. She would fight to the death if she had to. And that's when the van started to sway. Kiera was assaulted by nausea, and a wave of dizziness engulfed her. A terrible realization set in. The guy behind her, the one in the mask, had something soft and wet in his hand. Why hadn't she noticed this before? As the chloroform kicked in, he tightened the seal over Kiera's mouth, and she fixed her panicked gaze on Kyla.
Why?
She tried to groan the words, but they came out muffled and ragged in the masked man's hand.
Kyla. Sister. Why?
2. It took Saxon Olaru nearly an hour to make it back to the Lodo bar. He had to search every passing vehicle for female passengers, peruse every open restaurant scanning for the same, and enter every high-rise apartment along the city route while rendering his body invisible. He could not leave a single stone unturned, not when it came to finding and claiming his destiny. As it stood, she had to be within reach, reach being a relative term. At that fateful moment, when the moon had turned blood red, his destiny had been somewhere close, nearby, within his grasp. The curse of their kind guaranteed it. But 30 seconds here, 60 seconds there, an extra block or two traversed, and Saxon could have easily missed her. He had missed her. And if he didn't find her soon, he was going to call out to Julian Lacusta and Saber Alexiaris, ask the vampires to get their asses to Denver post-haste. He had already briefed the tracker on the final resolution of the Vosu stalkers, and he hated to bother him again, but he would if he had to. With the help of Nathaniel Silivasi, Saber could set up a perimeter, make sure no one got in or out, while Julian started hunting, tracing every female scent he detected from the bar to the freeway, working his way one soul at a time, scent by scent, block by block, female after human female. It would be painstaking, methodical, and slow, but Saxon wouldn't hesitate to ask the tracker to do it, at least if it came to that. His muscles tense, his fangs still throbbing, he yanked on the door to the bar, nearly tugging it off the hinges. He stalked inside, scanned the bar stools and booths, and started to pace toward the kitchen. And that was when he saw her, standing in the hallway just feet from the door to the restroom. He immediately sent an imperious mental command to all the bar's gawking patrons.
Look away. Nothing to see here, folks.
Then he turned his attention back to the woman. She was clutching her left wrist in her right hand, staring at the cryptic markings. And as Saxon zoomed in, he was taken aback by the glaring, unsettling visage. The constellation, the stars of Cetus, looking more like abrasions, dark, painful wounds than a seamless stamp by a deity. For lack of a better description, the enigmatic emblem looked more like a fresh tattoo. But that wasn't possible, unless the gods had chosen to harm her. But why? He blinked in confusion and stared at her face. She was breathless, she was flushed, and she looked positively petrified. Well, that at least made some sense. She had to know something unnatural was happening. And as for the raw, mysterious nature of the brand on her wrist, humans did not know about the vampire, and they sure as heck didn't know about the celestial gods. There was no way this frightened human female could have known about Saxon's blood moon, orchestrated what was happening in the sky, and predicted that his ruling lord was Cetus. There was no way she could have manipulated the curse. Saxon was staring at his destiny, and he needed to get her out of there. He peered briefly inside her mind to examine her most recent thoughts, and once again he drew back in surprise. She wasn't thinking anything. Her mind was curiously, if not purposefully, blank. Well, that wasn't entirely true. There was one particular thought, a repetitive refrain playing over and over in an endless loop. What's wrong with my arm? What's wrong with my arm? What's wrong with my arm? Saxon licked his bottom lip, stole her name from her frontal lobe, and seared an imperious compulsion directly into her mind.
Kyla, come to me.
He held out his hand and waited. She jerked back, let go of her arm, and stared fixedly ahead, biting her lower lip in trepidation. Her dark brown eyes met his, and she inhaled sharply, before brushing a thick cluster of waist-length blonde hair behind her ear and over her slender shoulder. She gulped and he repeated the command.
Come to me, Kyla.
She began to shuffle forward, instinctively tucking her arm behind her. Again, that was odd, but it really didn't matter. Saxon had already seen it. He knew who she was.
Shh,
he whispered as she trembled before him, her toes almost touching his. He bent his head to whisper in her ear, and placed a soft, gentle hand on her shoulder.
Take my hand, little one, and follow me outside. Do not be afraid. I will not harm you.
She linked her hand in his and held on loosely as he led her out of the bar, around the corner, and into a dark, concealed storefront, a narrow, shadowed nook.
Be at ease.
He rasped, as he gently rotated her body until she was leaning against the wall, and he was towering above her. He took in her appearance a second time, studying her more closely. She was pretty, very pretty. Beautiful, actually. Her dark brown eyes were the color of chestnuts, and perfectly oval in shape. Her features were elegant, almost aristocratic, soft, noble, and refined. Her cheekbones were high and distinctly outlined, the same with her delicate chin. And her complexion was smooth, baby-fine, and unblemished. Her lips were heart-shaped and perfect, not too thick, not too thin, with a soft rosy color that seemed natural. He deepened his compulsion.
Kyla, my name is Saxon Olaru, and I have waited a lifetime to find you. I know that none of this makes sense, at least not right now. But please, don't be afraid of me.
He swept the backs of his fingers along her sculpted cheek ever so slowly and whispered,
I have no intentions of harming you. If anything, I wish to learn how to worship you. Come home with me this night. It is time for our journey to begin.
The last sentence was rhetorical, of course. No sane, self-respecting woman would simply comply with such an entreaty from a stranger. But Kyla was under Saxon's compulsion, and his voice, his vampiric power, left her no room to refuse him. Which is why her ensuing reply caught him so off guard.
Saxon.
She tried his name on her tongue, just a tentative whisper, and then she nodded.
Your words. Your speech. It's definitely unorthodox. But it doesn't frighten me. Not at all.
Her heart was racing. Her palms were sweating. She was lying about her fear. But why?
This might sound crazy. As crazy as you sound to me. But I think I know you somehow. I think I've always known you.
He swallowed his desire to speak and listened more attentively.
I...
She reached up to smooth her thumb along his jaw, and he almost jolted. It was so unexpected.
I've seen your face a dozen times in my dreams.
She glanced askance, shyly, as if suddenly ashamed.
Does that sound crazy?
He shook his head. Of course it didn't.
I mean, I don't believe in soulmates or even divine coincidence, but the moment you stepped into that bar, I knew you. I remembered you. I felt your presence like someone I've always known, someone I would recognize anywhere. And now you're standing here beneath the most amazing supernatural red moon. It almost feels like an omen, if that makes any sense.
He was about to question her further, ask more about these dreams, when he thought better of it. She was speaking from her own free will, in spite of the compulsion he had woven around her, and she was studying him so intensely, memorizing his features, that he didn't want to break her concentration. Above and beyond all that, she had both seen and made note of the Cetus blood moon. Perhaps the gods had already seen to their pairing, prepared the groundwork for a decade. When her dark curly lashes dropped to half-mast, scanning his lips, his eyes, then his lips again, he nearly shuddered. Saxon O'Laru was no babe in the woods. He was no stranger to female flirtation. While most vampires avoided intimate liaisons for fear of getting too involved, for fear of an unplanned pregnancy, Saxon had always sought and needed the intimacy of a woman's touch. His strikingly handsome face had drawn females to his path like moths to a flame, and he had learned to discern their intentions. Hell, even their psyches. He knew which ones he could find solace in, share a tender moment with, versus those who would end up being hurt or attached. He knew how to give pleasure and how to take the same, how to leave a human female feeling fulfilled rather than empty, and he knew how to use protection. Both physically and mentally. He knew how to avoid even a momentary musing, a passing thought that might lead to pregnancy. Saxon O'Laru knew how to charm, how to seduce, and how to tease. And he knew when a woman had just invited him to kiss her. Drawing in a shallow breath, he bent his head to hers, tunneled his fingers in her long blonde hair and drew her closer into his body. And then he pressed his lips to hers. Softly at first, just a mere touch, the flutter of a butterfly's wings. Then he molded his soft but firm lips to Kyla's in a perfect erotic union. He tasted the tip of her tongue with a slow, teasing swipe, catching the same with his full bottom lip, and then he gentled his pressure against her mouth, and leisurely, sensually pulled away. Her knees buckled beneath her, and he caught her by the waist, flashing a heartbreaking, endearing smile.
I wasn't expecting that.
His voice was deep and husky, betraying his rising interest. She nodded and shivered.
I wasn't either.
She blushed and looked away. She gulped and stood there silently.
You what?
He encouraged, wanting to hear her full thoughts. She chuckled softly.
I don't usually do that. I mean, not with a man I just met.
He brushed that same cluster of hair behind her ear once again and ran his finger down the slope of her neck.
It's okay.
She shook her head emphatically.
Kyla, it's okay.
She shyly bit her lip.
Thanks. I guess. I think what I was going to say...
She paused to bite her lip again, only this time it seemed like a nervous tick.
"Is just that... just that..."
"Just that?"
he prompted.
"I'm not going to sleep with you,"
she blurted, her eyes growing wide in surprise, presumably at her own audacity.
"I mean, just because I kissed you."
She bit her lower lip a third time, then lowered her gaze toward the ground.
I'm not that kind of girl."
Saxon laughed quietly, a melodious, sonorous sound.
"Okay,"
he purred.
"I wasn't making any assumptions."
She breathed a sigh of relief.
"Kyla," he said firmly, "you have nothing to fear from me, honestly."
He winked.
"Besides, I'm not that kind of guy."
She laughed, and he took an enormous chance by releasing the last of his compulsion, just to test the waters. He hoped she wouldn't scream.
"Come home with me this night, and we'll figure it out from there."
To his utter astonishment, his destiny agreed. Kyla Sparrow told her heart to stop racing, her mind to slow down, and her libido to heal. Good Lord Almighty, the male was an angel, or the devil in disguise. His sweet hazel eyes, with numerous speckles of gold, were deep-set, enchanting, and endlessly hypnotic. His eyebrows were perfectly straight and full, with just a hint of an arch above his pupils and his cheekbones. She could see every hollow and bony ridge. They were sculpted to finite precision. His nose belonged in an anatomy book as an example of structural perfection. And those lips. Good Lord, give her strength. That full bottom lip was perfectly round and slightly turned out in temptation. The masculine slope of his upper lip was thinner in the corners, almost sardonic, growing thick as it crested in the center. Pouty, slightly arrogant, yet firm. She could stare at those lips forever. Never mind what he tasted like. And his hair, his goatee, the way the former framed his face, and the latter defined his jaw. He had been created to tantalize women. And Kyla had to be careful. Very, very careful. So far, she had played everything just right. She had shown the proper amount of fear when he'd approached her in the bar. She had recognized a light dusting of fog in her mind, the almost imperceptible hint of compulsion as she'd followed him outside. And she had fought to resist the vampiric haze, if only for a few short moments, in order to entice him, in order to gain his trust. She had even mentioned the supernatural blood moon as if she could really see it. It was imperative that she went along with this claiming, that she didn't raise any suspicions. If the vampire chose to invade her thoughts, to take any long-term memories, she was screwed. She could not give him a reason to do so. As it stood, she had to exhibit just enough interest to appease him, but not so much that she seemed too eager. She had to walk a fine, fragile line, which meant she had to check her libido. Sex was out, at least for now. What if he became motivated to insist on an early conversion, in order to command a pregnancy? She shivered at the thought. Not only would the conversion fail, but even if she secretly relinquished her immortal soul to try to make a transformation work, pregnancy would be a no-go. Saxon would know within 7 to 8 hours, the equivalent of a 6-week human gestation, that there weren't any detectable heartbeats. He would know that something was wrong. Kyla softened her expression and breathed a sigh of relief, just as he spoke again.
"Kyla," he said firmly, "you have nothing to fear from me, honestly."
He winked and her stomach did a little flip.
"Besides, I'm not that kind of guy."
He paused as if making his own internal calculations, and she felt the vampiric haze lift from all around her. He was releasing her from his compulsion.
"Come home with me this night, and we'll figure it out from there."
Kyla smiled faintly. So he was trusting her without coercion, testing the strength of their celestial bond. She met his gaze directly and flashed a sheepish smile.
"Okay,"
she whispered.
"Let's go."
3. Kiera Sparrow woke up on the top floor of a dimly lit warehouse. She knew she was on the top floor because there was moonlight shining down from a skylight like a macabre organic cone on a stage. Her arms were stretched taut above her head. Her wrists were cuffed to two iron bars, and she was tethered to the headboard of a giant wood and iron bed. She gasped even as she stifled a scream, and her eyes darted frantically around her. Where the hell was she? What the hell had happened? And why did she feel so strange? Her body was fatigued, she was curiously dizzy, and her head felt like someone had split it with an axe. But why? The memories flooded in with a whoosh. She had been standing in the unisex bathroom of the bar in Lodo, chatting with Kyla, when two terrifying strangers had rushed in. The man with a mask had drugged her and dragged her to a van. And Kyla had let him do it. No, Kyla had actually helped him. What the hell was going on? She stretched her neck to peek through a bricked-in architectural cove, occupying half or more of a wall. With its custom-fitted wrought-iron insert, it served as an interior window, opening the sight lines to the rest of the warehouse. Glancing further into the space, she immediately furrowed her brow. The warehouse wasn't empty. In fact, it was appointed like a lavish, upscale apartment with an opulent open floor plan. There was a living room in the center, extravagantly decored with art, floor rugs, and high-end furnishings. A kitchen facing the living room with cherry cabinets, granite counters, and travertine flooring, and two bedrooms toward the back of the building, each edging a cement wall and sharing an enormous open bathroom with two similar bricked-in alcoves. While the bathroom was semi-enclosed, it accessed through two adjoining bedroom doors. The wrought-iron window inserts allowed Kiera to see distinctive elements from the room's interior. A Tuscan bricked-in shower, an opulent jetted tub, two copper sinks, and two hidden water closets on either side of the basin, connecting the ensuite to each of the abutted bedrooms. Kiera was in the bedroom to the right. She scanned the lofty open space one more time. It was a home without walls, but it had to be a million-dollar spread, and that meant her captors were men of serious means. Speaking of her captors, she craned her neck to the left and then the right, trying to get a glimpse of an abductor. Surely they hadn't left her there alone. No sooner had the thought crossed her mind than a heavy, barn-style door at the front of the warehouse slid open, and two familiar males sauntered in, one carrying a long wooden case in his hand as he stepped out of a rustic elevator.
"She's awake,"
the short, stocky guy with a dozen tattoos grumbled, hustling across the wooden floor toward the bed.
"Don't touch her,"
the second guy warned. This was definitely the same man who'd been wearing a mask, the one now carrying the case, and he followed on the first guy's heels, ambling with utter confidence.
"The headhunter said she was not to be harmed. Not a single hair on her head. In fact, Xavier said she's his. And if anyone violates her, he'll disembowel them himself."
The short, stocky creep glanced over his shoulder and blanched.
"Damn, Owen. That bastard is rough."
"Yeah," Owen said. "He is, and he means what he says."
"I got it,"
Tattoo replied.
"Travis?"
"I got it,"
he repeated angrily. So her captors were named Owen and Travis. That was good to know. But who the hell was Xavier? Kiera bit back a snarl of rage, gritting her teeth in disgust as her captors approached the bed. Owen appraised her tethered body from head to toe, then back up again, and she wanted to spit in his face.
"How long have you been awake?"
he asked. Kiera cleared her throat. Her head was still pounding, and she tried to sound braver than she felt.
"Who the hell are you? And what do you want with me? Where's Kyla? What did you do to my sister?"
Owen sat down beside her, setting the case on the floor, and the mattress depressed from his weight. Her body tilted and rolled to the side, being sucked into the depression by gravity, but the tethers stopped her decline, causing her arms to stretch and ache. The asshole stroked her cheek with a lazy right hand, and Kiera visibly trembled.
"Don't touch me," she snarled.
"Let's get one thing straight right off the bat, Miss Sparrow,"
the tall, arrogant bastard spat.
You don't ask the questions around here, and you don't make demands. He tapped his chest in a brazen show of dominance. I'm Owen, and this is Travis. He pointed at his friend. And the fact that you know our names ought to tell you everything you need to know. You're not going home. Not ever. He leaned in closer until his face was hovering 5 or 6 inches above hers, and he smiled. If it wasn't for the boss's orders, we would have slit your throat in the van and left you in a dumpster. But as it stands, the chief wants you alive. He wants to study your blood, and he has a personal affinity for the violin. He glanced down at the case near his ankles. That means you're going to play for him whenever he asks, and if I were you, I would play my best. Kiera recoiled at Owen's words, all of them. They would have slit her throat, left her in a dumpster. Their boss wanted to study her blood. What the hell was happening? And how could anyone expect her to play the violin under such appalling circumstances? Owen nodded at Travis, then glanced down at the wooden case, and the short, stocky sycophant jumped like a puppet on a string. He crossed to the bed in 2 clumsy strides, picked up the resting instrument, and placed it on the mattress. Then he fumbled with the latches, his thumbs too fat to slide them upward until he finally got it open. He raised the case to show her the cheap, worn-out violin. Kiera frowned. And, she thought, what the hell was she supposed to say? The musician inside her was disgusted. You don't throw a violin into an unsecured wooden box. You place it in a padded violin case. As it was, the bridge had collapsed from the weight of the lid. The bow hairs were wrapped around the pegs, and the brutes had managed to scratch the belly. Not that any of that mattered right now.
Can you play it?
Travis snorted. Kiera just shook her head in amazement, in horror and disbelief. None of this was real. This simply could not be happening.
Can you play it?
Owen echoed, his domineering voice packed in ice. Kiera perused the violin a second time.
Yeah, she muttered. If I can fix it, I can play it, but not as well as you'd like.
Why not?
Owen barked. Kiera tried to quiet her mind. The only thing she was thinking about was how to get away. How to escape these obvious sociopaths. But maybe if she was smart, the violin could work in her favor. At best, it could buy her some time to think. And plan, and maneuver. She spoke in a trembling voice.
There's no shoulder rest or rosin, and it may need a brand new bridge.
When they didn't object, she continued.
And the bow needs to be rehaired. It's useless as it is.
Owen wrinkled his brow, and Travis shot him a questioning glance.
You think Xavier gives a shit?
He asked. Owen shrugged.
Don't know, but I'm not gonna be the one to piss him off. You?
Travis cringed and shook his head. Damn, who the heck was Xavier?
Nah, Travis replied. Better get what she needs.
Owen nodded, and Kiera felt her heart lighten, if only a little bit. In truth, she could play the instrument with or without a shoulder rest, although she preferred the former. And the bow would still make sound without the rosin. It just wouldn't be as rich. It wouldn't grip and fully vibrate the strings or make the instrument sing. Still, the more items they had to fetch and the more specialty shops they had to go to, the longer they would be absent from the warehouse. The more time she would have to try to escape. She fought to steady her voice.
If we're still in Denver, there's a good luthier on Broadway. He can change out the bridge and rehair the bow. But you should probably go to Armando's string shop to buy some rosin and a pack of new strings. I prefer Melos Dark and Eva Perazzi Gold, but I'll need to see the E-string, whether it's a ball or a loop. And you need a better case, she added. Or it's just going to keep on breaking. The violin is a delicate instrument.
Owen studied her carefully, like he was searching for hints of deception.
Don't fuck with me, Kiera, he warned.
She quickly glanced away.
I'm not.
He grinded his teeth and nodded at a nearby 2-drawer nightstand.
Travis, get her a pen and some paper, then untie her hands. Yes, we're still in Denver, so you can make a detailed list, Miss Sparrow.
He spoke her name as a formal title, with unconcealed derision. Specific parts, the names of shops, everything you need. Just get it right the first time. We're not your personal lackeys. Kiera gulped. She was anxious for Travis to untie her hands so she could move her fingers and get her blood flowing, and that gave her another advantage.
I don't know who this Xavier is or why he wants me to play, but you should both think twice about binding my wrists so tightly. My music comes from my hands.
Owen toggled his head from side to side as if he were thinking it over. His eyes narrowed in contempt, his lips turned down in a scowl, and then he reached out and slapped her, so harshly, so quickly, she never saw the correction coming. "You are an extremely arrogant bitch," he snarled, "and your princess days are over." She gasped in pain and alarm as his long, knobby fingers wrapped around her throat. "I revere Xavier Matista," he spat, "and we will get him what he wants. But don't get things confused, Miss Sparrow. You are nothing but a stray, mangy dog to me. My boss will understand if I have to put you down." Kiera froze. She closed her eyes and listened to her heart's frantic beating. It was clamoring like an agitated metronome in her chest.
"I'm sorry," she whispered,
desperate to calm him down. But she wasn't sorry. She was furious, and she was trapped. How dare he call her an arrogant bitch? He didn't know a thing about her. Yet and still, she wasn't stupid enough to incite more violence. If anything, she was desperate to try to read him, to try to figure the situation out. Travis was a low-level flunky. He was probably too stupid to think for himself. And Owen, he was cut from a different but just as evil cloth. Intelligent, self-important, and obviously successful. But his pride was his weakness, and it might be his undoing if this Xavier Matista was as dangerous as they let on. Perhaps Kiera could play one against the other. Either way, she needed to hedge her bets, and that meant she needed to win over the boss. One way or another, this headhunter, as they called him, would be Kiera's ultimate salvation. Either that, or he would be her final damnation. 4. Saxon Olaru rolled his eyes as he stepped outside onto his high clifftop veranda, with its stunning views of the vista below. Acres of forest filled with towering pines, quaking aspens, and green or blue spruce trees, meandering rivers snaking through the valley, and a hidden mountain lake abutting the edge of the western vale. He stared blankly at his twin Ramsey, and then his older brother Santos, before sighing in frustration. It was 3:30 in the morning. Saxon and Kyla had just made it back to the clifftop retreat about 15 minutes earlier.